And we're back. This is welcome to episode 14 of Stempoint. I'm Gabe Groisman, and things look a little bit different here because I'm actually in Boca Raton, and there's only one thing that can bring me up to Boca. It's just an hour from Miami, and that's my friend Ben Shapiro. It's such an honor. I'm so excited to have Ben on the podcast. I am not going to do an introduction, a background on Ben. To all the listeners, if you don't know who Ben Shapiro is, please sign off and turn on another podcast. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Good to see you.
So happy you're here, and really for a few reasons. And the first one I was thinking about today that I'll share with the audience is, you know, we're friends. We've had a relationship for a few years now, and people only know you and how you address issues in the public way. You know, usually you're talking at the microphone. Everyone listens to you at half speed or whatever it is to try to hear what you're saying and all the great insights you're giving, or you're quote unquote destroying people in these debates and having these back and forth discussions. But being friends with you, I kind of get the insight of another side, which is, you know, you like to actually thoughtfully think through things, and your positions are actually backed by, you know, really well thought out positions. And there's a lot of complicated issues that are going on in the world that you talk about a lot and that you've been addressing with a lot of the production you've done lately. So I figured we'd get together, talk through some of those and hear what you really think about it.
Sounds good. All right.
Amazing. So let's jump right in. A couple weeks ago, if not last week, you put out a big video on supporting Trump.
Yes.
Explaining why you're supporting him. I am as well. Like, you know, we were both DeSantis guys. We've both turned a new page, and we're with Trump. I'm not going to ask you why you're supporting Trump. You've already exhausted that. But what do you think Trump needs to do to win? And the reason I'm asking that is the media is against him. He really getting his messaging out there, what he offers to the country, why he should be the president again. We don't even hear that because the media really blocks that. Social media blocks that. So what do you think he really needs to do to bring home a victory?
I mean, I think there are only two things that he needs to do. One of them is quite doable, and the other, who knows? The first one is he needs to obviously have an excellent vote-getting operation. This was really missing in 2020. He was encouraging people not to vote by mail while Democrats were encouraging everybody to vote by mail. That's why about 66% of Democrats who voted in the 2020 election voted by mail. That number was, I think, 30% for Republicans. And so that's why you saw that big blue shift happen the night of the election, is because they were counting all the mail-in ballots, and those were heavily stacked toward Democrats. Meanwhile, President Trump was literally telling people not to vote by mail. He then did the same thing in Georgia and ended up basically losing a couple Senate seats in Georgia because of it. You vote how you can vote, and you get people out how you can get people out. And so doing what Governor DeSantis has done in Florida, which is whatever is the legal way to get out the vote, get out the vote, is number one. That means you need a serious vote-getting operation in Georgia, in Arizona, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada. Right? Those are the states this entire election is going to come down to. Right? If Trump loses Georgia, the election is over. He's lost too many states. If he loses Arizona, the election's over. He's lost too many states. If he wins both of those, then obviously he has to take at least a couple of the others. And there's a pretty good shot that he could do that, which brings us to issue number two, which is what he campaigns on. And the best thing for him to do would be to pursue Joe Biden's 2020 strategy of not being alive. That'd be the best strategy for him. He needs to go into a basement somewhere, and he needs to go to sleep, and he will wake up president. Because the reality is, the more people think about Biden, the more they dislike Biden. The more people think about Trump, the more they dislike Trump. Trump's numbers are pretty well set, 45 to 47%. Those numbers could theoretically go up based on the number of people who really don't like Joe Biden. If this election is a referendum on Biden, Trump wins. If the election is a referendum on Trump, then Trump loses. And so what that means is that taking away the ammunition for the Democrats is going to be vital. Now, I will say that there's an advantage to Trump here in the sense that he's not saying anything that we haven't heard before. I mean, he's been in the public consciousness as president or ex-president for almost a decade at this point. And so that means, like, what else could he say at this point that would really shock anyone? It's hard for me to think of anything he could say that would shock anything.
The media is trying, right? We already saw it with the bloodbath comment when he's talking about the auto industry.
And it's not going to work because, again, you tell people enough times that the wolf is at the door and then it turns out just to be not the wolf. And I'm not sure people are going to believe that. That said, what could come out of Trump's mouth is an unknown unknown. I really have no clue. You know, he's historically found a way to say something that is out of the box. If he could keep that reined in, even I would say, like, you know, how I would speak, but even to kind of the lesser side of his normal, I think that he'll win. Right now, he certainly has a lot of systemic advantages in the election. Joe Biden is deeply unpopular. Nobody thinks he's making it through a second term, and his vice president is even more unpopular than he is. So if I were a betting man, I would be betting on Trump right now. We'll see how the global situation plays out. It's hard for me to believe that all of the fires that Joe Biden has helped light all over the world are going to go out by the time of the election, or that the economy is going to be in such staggeringly amazing shape that Americans are going to completely swivel 180 and think that things are going great. Biden's got a heap of trouble on his hands.
Yeah, but for me, I think it's all about narrative because, you know that, and I know those things. But if the narrative isn't out there in the media, if the everyday voters, the 43% of independents in this country, don't hear what Trump is out there actually saying, right? There's actually a message of you were better off. It's pretty simple. You were better off when I was president. The world was quieter and more peaceful when I was president. Vote for me. You'll have that again, right? That's a pretty simple message, but we're not hearing that anywhere, right? So I think that's the really his most difficult thing to overcome because usually earned media wins you the election, right? I mean, it's a one in a million election, probably the first time because he was so bombastic and exciting. They were covering all coverage. News coverage is good news coverage. At least all media is good media. That's what he would say.
To be fair, I think that the reason that he won the first election is because everyone thought he was going to lose, meaning that he didn't actually wildly outperform what Republicans in the past have outperformed on either a raw vote level or a percentage level. In Wisconsin, Mitt Romney won more raw votes in 2012 than Donald Trump won in 2016, but Trump won the state. And that's because Democrats have been operating under a false assumption since 2012 that they could create a majority-minority coalition along with some college-educated white liberal women and that would be enough. You just go to the base over and over and over and you'll win because Obama was able to do that in 2012. But that's not duplicable. You can't do that if you're not Barack Obama. He's one of one. He's charismatic. He's going to get extraordinarily high black turnout. Is that going to be duplicated for Joe Biden at 82 in 2024? I have serious doubts. The only reason that he won in 2020 is because all the rules changed. And so what you saw was this massive increase in the size of the American electorate. So normally, an American electorate between presidential elections might increase by 4 or 5 million voters. That'd be like at the upper end. The last election cycle, the number of voters increased by at least 20 million voters, which is totally unusual. It's unprecedented. And so what you're going to get is a receding back to the norm. And as the number of votes recedes back to the norm, I'm going to say this is a low turnout election. This is particularly a low turnout election for Biden, and that's a serious problem for him. It's the reason why he's trying to jazz his left-wing base. He thinks that he's not going to do particularly well with independents, and that's what the stats are showing right now. And so he's thinking, okay, I'm going to duplicate what Obama did. I'm going to get my base out to vote. And that's why he's throwing Israel under the bus, for example, in Michigan. It's why he's still trying to jazz up the environmentalists with pauses on natural gas. It's not going to work. There is no one who jazzes up the public less than Joe Biden. I mean, he's a walking corpse, and everyone knows it. And you can't get people out to vote that way. So, again, I think that it's less about narrative and more about Donald Trump just standing there pointing at Joe Biden. I don't even think you have to believe that things are going to be better if they're like 2019. I think if people have a bad mood about the country and then they look at the president and the president is a doddering old man who can't string together a sentence and seems like he's going to walk into a wall any moment, I think he's toast at that point. I really think it's that simple. And again, 2016 was not about Donald Trump being an extraordinary candidate. It was about Hillary Clinton being an extraordinarily bad candidate. It was a confluence of two factors. One, everyone thought that Hillary was going to win. And so a lot of Democrats didn't show up because they're like, you know what? It's cold outside. She's going to beat the crap out of him anyway, just not going to show up. And then Trump wins. And two, people aren't going to show up to vote for her out of enthusiasm because nobody liked Hillary Clinton. And that sounds a lot like Joe Biden. It sounds a lot like Joe Biden. I mean, the only difference is that people think Trump might actually win. But his poll numbers are really durable. He hasn't been losing in the Real Clear Politics polling average since like September of last year. If he's even with it, and remember, these polls tend to undersample Trump voters by a couple of points. If Trump is within even a point of Joe Biden in the popular vote, he's going to win the election. He doesn't actually have to win the popular vote. You could actually end up with a weird situation in which Trump wins the popular vote and loses the election, right? That actually could happen this year. You could have a situation in which he wins the popular vote by a couple million votes, but they're not in the right places, right? Yeah. He loses in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania by like super narrow margins. I don't know. It could go either way, but again, I think advantage Trump at this point.
I think the third element that you're leaving out is the excitement that Trump garnered.
His base is going to show up. Yeah. Well, people like me, I'm not even a part of like Trump's traditional base, right? I didn't vote in 2016 at all at the top level. In 2020, I voted for him and endorsed him. But again, yeah, I know all the flaws of Donald Trump. I'm not sure there's anybody on the right who has pointed out those flaws as often as I have. And
is still standing.
And is still standing, yeah. And look, I'm a donor to him this time around. To stop Joe Biden, I will walk over broken glass to vote for Donald Trump. And that's putting aside people who would have walked over broken glass to vote for him in 2020.
Right. I don't know if you've ever seen Andrew Schultz, the comedian. He has he has a skit in his stand-up routine, and a special about he judges a presidential candidate based on how much merch he can move, and no one moved merch like Trump. He's you don't see anybody walking around with Biden hats.
I mean,
right?
What I love about Trump is that it's not just that he moves merch; he moves the most boomer merch that has ever merched.
Right.
I mean, it's not cool. It's not interesting. It's not like Barack Obama has like an awesome logo and you'd like want to be seen at the park wearing it.
Yeah, the MAGA hat is hard to wear.
The MAGA hat is like what my family was buying at the family reunion in 1997 at like the Minneapolis Mall, right? Yeah. Like at the Mall of America. It's like a block family reunion at the Minnesota Mall. Like it's that kind of thing, right? It doesn't even fold properly on your head. It like has this made of styrofoam.
You have to understand Trump because you see that hat. You can see that hat from a mile away. That's 100%. All he cares about.
As a piece of branding, it's genius. And that has always been Trump's genius, right? Trump, more blasphemy. Trump is not an amazing business person. He's an incredible branding presence. His ability to brand is unparalleled in modern American history. As a businessman, but as a branding guy, the guy's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, the businessman thing may change now with Truth Social, which is a whole other discussion. We'll see how that pans out. But let's talk about Biden a little bit, because you've actually been making efforts now with your new series on Divided States of America, which is very interesting. You had one episode on fentanyl, if I'm not mistaken,
and the other one on the border.
And why that's interesting is there's a lot of headlines on Biden. People are saying, you know, he's the worst president in history. He's the best president in history, but no one really digs into what he's doing. And I think you're doing that a lot. You want to talk a little bit about what you're doing as far as what the big project is and what you're trying to show?
Sure. I mean, so one of the things that you were talking about earlier, the narrative question, people will point out there's a fentanyl problem or there's a border problem. But one of the things I wanted to do is personally go down to these places and take whatever spotlight I can and put them on the actual locations and then talk in depth with the people who are living through this issue and have them explain exactly what's going on. So in our border episode, we went down to the part of the border that nobody talks about in Arizona, which is where most of the fentanyl is coming through. And we talked with Brandon Judd, who's the head of the National Border Patrol Officers Union. And he explained exactly what's going on there. And you could drive the border for 20 miles and see no Border Patrol officers, none. You could see places they'd cut right through the Trump border wall. And, you know, it's still not intact. So, you know, that was episode one. Episode two, which was, I think, much more disturbing even than that, was we actually went and saw the wages of the fentanyl epidemic in places like Kensington, which is an area of Philadelphia. And it is horrifying. I mean, it's truly horrifying. It is zombie land. It's people who are just walking around, stoned out of their mind, high. Their body's racked because these drugs. They'll mix fentanyl with an animal tranquilizer they call Trank, and it literally withers away their body. I mean, they have like open abscesses. People who are missing limbs, who are shooting themselves up openly on the street. Miles of people just shooting each other up on the street. We when we were driving it, we make a left into off of the main drag, Kensington Avenue, and there's a blocked off street with some cop cars there, and that's because we were told by the people we were riding along with that somebody obviously had died right there, and they blocked off the street. We make another left, we go another block, another street is blocked off because somebody has died there. I mean, it's astonishing. And we also went to Camden, New Jersey, which is one of the places where they're selling a lot of the drug out of. We talked to parents of kids who died of fentanyl poisoning, and it is poisoning. A lot of the people who are dying are not dying of overdose. Typically, when you think of overdose, you think of somebody took coke, but they took too much coke, and then they died. When it's fentanyl, some of the people who are dying intended to take fentanyl. A lot of people dying did not intend to take fentanyl. They took what they thought was an Adderall, and it was laced with fentanyl, or they smoked a joint, and it turned out that there was fentanyl in it, and now they're dead. And you know that sort of stuff is truly devastating. And the fact that this is all coming across our southern border, and it would be very easy for the United States to shut our southern border, that's the part that's really amazing, is that we're supposed to pretend like there are no solutions to this. There's a very obvious solution to this. There's not a good solution to drug addiction. Right? That there are a huge variety of sources for drug addiction, ranging from familial breakdown to lack of religious life. But when it comes to stopping the flow of this particular drug, that is coming, a huge percentage of it is coming across our unmanned southern border. And that could be stopped tomorrow if Joe Biden would put a couple of provisions in place, and he's not doing it.
Well, the Mexican president, like you saw, I'm sure, yesterday was out speaking, saying it's not coming from Mexico and the majority of it's being made in the U.S.
It's just a lie,
and you can't, and you can't close the border because you rely on us, on our factories, and you're not going to be able to get cheap cars anymore. I haven't heard a response from President Biden. Have you?
No, I have not heard any response from President Biden on that. And let's be real about that. We could actually shut the parts of the border that we're talking about. We're not talking about the ability to ship cars up through the border. Last I checked, they weren't like going in the off-roading areas of Arizona and shipping Hyundais up there or something. I mean, those are all coming through ports of entry. The vast majority of the drug right now, my understanding is not coming through ports of entry. It's coming between ports of entry. You can shut down those sites easily. I mean, that just requires Border Patrol presence.
Right. And what's also incredible is, you know, people, you even alluded to it as the Trump border wall. And the wall actually started getting rebuilt under Obama. He issued all the contracts and started extending the wall. He was considered the deporter in chief. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he deported more people than every other president put together for the previous 100 years. I remember people.
The kids in cages started under Barack Obama.
The kids in cages, people were chaining themselves to the White House fences. That's a fence that's under Obama. Trump continued it. Trump did stay in Mexico, you know, all these different things. And the fentanyl thing, though, can you talk a little bit about its connection to the border? Because I think people are really missing it. I know it comes across the border, but explain a little bit of that.
Basically, China manufactures the fentanyl directly, or they send all the precursor chemicals for the fentanyl to Mexico. There are actual Chinese-owned bases or controlled bases in Mexico, controlled by Chinese nationals. They're using Chinese pill presses in order to press fentanyl, for example, into things that look like Adderall. And then they're working with the Mexican drug cartels to smuggle all that up through the southern border. That's how fentanyl is chiefly entering the United States. And so there is this pipeline that goes from China to Mexico to the United States. There are a couple ways to interdict that. One way would be to obviously shut America's southern border. That's something that Biden has shown no inclination to do. The other would be to put heavy economic pressure on the Chinese government to stop the shipping of these precursors over to Mexico in the first place. The Biden administration has also been unwilling to do that because so much of the American economy is intertwined with the Chinese economy. And Biden realizes that with everything that his administration has done wrong, if there's an economic downturn, he's totally toast. So if there's a trade war with Mexico or with China, I think he's deeply afraid that it'll completely scuttle his reelect efforts.
Right. And obviously on the world stage, the U.S. doesn't have much strength that we've seen. We've seen it in the U.N. this week. Two incredible things happened. The first is the U.S. tried to introduce a measure, like you know, to call for a ceasefire that was contingent on the release of the hostages. That was vetoed by China, Russia, and Algeria, which shows that in and of itself shows the U.S. is standing there. They said the reason they're vetoing it because they don't want to support anything the U.S. is doing. And then the U.S. obviously, as you know, yesterday did not veto, abstained from, and allowed a U.N. resolution to pass that called, it did call for the release of hostages, but it also called for an immediate ceasefire immediately now in the month of Ramadan. One wasn't contingent on the other. Incredibly, the Jewish community also came out against Biden, including the apex of the world, which I was actually surprised about. I thought they were going to take
that. It was a little weak, but they did come out against it. Yeah,
the fact that they would say it, I'm not usually the guy out here defending that, but they really did. But, I mean, what I take from it is, look, the United Nations, they don't pass binding resolutions. It doesn't mean anything. The Israel can continue to do whatever it wants, but it does drive public opinion, and it's also indicative of where the U.S. is on this issue and also on public opinion within the United States, right? And
how it also changes the incentive structure for Hamas. So Hamas perceives correctly that they're winning the PR war. And when the United States abstains from a resolution like that, Hamas now realizes, and they made this obviously very, very clear immediately, that they have every piece of negotiating leverage with Israel. They immediately walked away from a hostage deal that the United States had been proposing. So the United States had an interest in vetoing that resolution specifically because it might push Hamas to the table. Because if they say, okay, we'll allow you to have the ceasefire if you release some hostages, then that pushes Hamas to the table. If they say we're disconnecting the issues and you can get both of those things, maintain the hostages and get the ceasefire, then walk away. And that's what Hamas did. Hamas immediately celebrates the UN resolution and declares that they are not going to sign on to a hostage deal that, by the way, is a terrible hostage deal for Israel. It involves the release of nearly 1,000 murderous terrorists. We're not talking about people who are, you know, like drug offender. We're talking about people who literally murdered people or were charged with accessory murder. And those people would be released into the north of Gaza, which means that Israel would then have to go and probably pick them up and capture them or kill them again in 5 minutes. So, you know, that itself was a bad deal. In my opinion, Israel should not have signed on to, but I understand why they would. Hamas walked away from that deal because they realized they have this negotiating leverage. The only leverage Hamas has is the softness of the American administration, is the only leverage they have in terms of negotiations. They do not have the military capacity to go up against Israel. That's been made absolutely clear. They do not have the longevity to go up against Israel. That's been made absolutely clear. They have one thing and one thing only: dead Palestinians they can shove in the faces of Americans and then say, we want you to stop your big, bad Israeli little brothers from doing this to us. And Joe Biden, because he wants to win Michigan, and that is the only thing that is happening here, because Joe Biden thinks that he has to appeal to the pro-Hamasniks in Michigan, he is attempting to draw daylight between Israel and the United States. Now, what's amazing about this is that it's so ignorant on every level by the Biden political team. It's stupid on every single level. So, number one, it's stupid to believe that abstaining from a UN resolution is going to buy the votes in Dearborn. It is not. They don't care about abstaining from a UN resolution. They want Israel to stop, and they want Hamas to be maintained. So unless the Biden administration is willing to take the overt public position that Bibi Netanyahu is both evil and wrong in this conflict, and that Hamas should maintain, and that Hamas should be given a state, and that that state should include Tel Aviv, the people in Dearborn are not going to vote for Joe Biden any more than they were before. And by the way, they probably will vote for Joe Biden anyway, because Donald Trump is on the other side of the ticket, the most pro-Israel president in American history. So that's piece of mislogic number one. Piece of mislogic number two. Joe Biden is not losing Michigan because of the 4,000 people who vote every time in Dearborn, Michigan. The population just isn't large enough. The reason that he's losing Michigan is because blue-collar workers in Michigan think he sucks. And they think he sucks because he does. He's bad at this. Joe Biden has hollowed out large parts of the manufacturing base in this country. He has no sympathy for the values of middle America. He's been catering to these upper-crust Ivy League white liberal women in terms of his political preferences. And so he's losing Michigan. I mean, that's his fault. That has nothing to do with Israel. If he thinks he's going to buy this thing back by drawing, like, a little more daylight with Bibi Netanyahu or sending out Chuck Schumer to do his dirty work and yell at Bibi, like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, the auto workers don't care what's happening.
Also, the Arabs in Michigan who like Hamas are not like, oh, well, you know, if they get rid of Bibi and they put in Benny Gantz, problem solved. You think they give it? They don't give any damns about whether it's Benny Gantz or Gadi Eisenkot or Bibi Netanyahu. It wouldn't matter for Yair Lapid. It wouldn't matter if it was Merav Mikhaeli. It wouldn't, like, none of it would matter.
That's actually true in general in America. The people who speak out against Israel who use...
Yeah, they don't care.
They say they have a problem with Bibi, not with Israel. But when Bennett was prime minister, they were equally anti-Israel.
And Lapid. Right. And I was saying this on Piers Morgan today. He was saying, well, you know, don't you think that Bibi's unpopular with the Israeli public? And I said, well, yes, but the entire Israeli public is agreed with Bibi that he has to go into Rafah. And in fact, if Israel does not go into Rafah, that government is going to fall. And the next government will go into Rafah because they have to. Right? The fact is that one of the most amazing things about watching Israeli politics from afar, when you actually know is something about Israeli politics, is this widespread perception promoted by the left-wing media in the United States that Bibi is some sort of deeply hawkish, precipitous leader.
Right.
He's the most incremental center-right leader in the history of international politics. That dude goes slow. He goes really slow. He's incredibly cautious.
If there's any criticism from the right in Israel is that he's not right-wing enough. He does not expand settlements, which is a big issue. He does not apply sovereignty.
Listen, the right was pushing him at the beginning of this war, not even to go into Hamas land. They were pushing him, go hit Hezbollah first.
Right.
And they were pushing him, why are you even going in with troops on the ground? You should be bombing more because you're putting Israeli lives. By the way, he is. I mean, the realistic truth is that the military plans that Israel actually implemented have ended with more dead Israeli soldiers, specifically because they've decided to try to take more care with Gazan civilians. And I keep pointing this out in the media, and nobody wants to listen to it, obviously, but the reality is Israel has complete air superiority. If you have complete air superiority over an enemy and you literally don't care about civilian casualties,
you just bomb them.
You just bomb them. But Israel isn't doing that. Israel has risked its own soldiers. I mean, you and I both know people who have been killed.
Yep.
And it's totally insane to suggest that Israel is trying to pursue some sort of precipitous, insane action in the Gaza Strip. It's a bunch of excuse-making for why you want to get back to your bullshit cycle of violence talk that was nonsense in the first place.
Yeah, I call it Miss America or Miss Universe talk, right?
I heard this today from somebody. Somebody said, oh, well, you know, isn't what Israel's doing generating more anger on the Palestinian side? Say, like, oh, you mean like before October 7th it was going amazing?
Right.
Like before October, like since 1948 it's been going tremendous. It turns out that all the concessions Israel has made, including giving up actual Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip, like that obviously worked out tremendously well. If only Israel would make more concessions, probably the Palestinians would be even more likely to make peace with Israel as opposed to like every single fact on the ground, including majority support for terror attacks throughout the existence of the Palestinians as a concerted people.
So just to close the loop on the issues with Biden and divided states of Biden and the different issues that you're trying to highlight that are happening around the country, going back to messaging is what I try to focus on a lot. If you look at the Democrats as a whole, of course, there's differences. You know, there's people who are really focused on these issues. But most people on the Democratic side who are with Biden today have an answer to everything, right? The big social issues don't exist. It's not true. The social issues are not really happening.
Or it's all abortion.
Right, or it's all abortion. Or the border is really Trump's problem, and then we could have fixed it if we would have just let this bill pass that was proposed in Congress. Right, for each one of these issues, there's an answer. They don't really point the blame ever at their own president. So how is it that we can break through how the Republican Party, Trump, those who are trying to get Trump elected, can push through on that narrative? Is there a way to get that, or are we really just going to have divided states of America and whoever turns out wins, and that's how we continue to govern?
You know, I just think that there are independents in the middle who are, they've made the difference in every single election. The only exception was 2012, which was a complete base election, but that was the only one in our lifetime where independents didn't actually make up the margin of difference. Every single other election, if they broke in favor of one candidate, that candidate won. 2012, independents broke for Romney and he lost. That was the only exception. So what that means, the independents likely will make up the ground. And again, Donald Trump's pitch is very simple. The person who is president is responsible for what is happening right now in the United States. The year on the calendar is 2024. I have not been president since 2021. What is happening right now in the United States is on the guy who's there. If you like it, vote for him. If you don't like it, then you should probably think of voting some other way.
Yeah, one thing you said, I think, that a few weeks ago that I heard and I've repeated and given you credit when I've remembered, is this election is very easy. If you liked Trump as president, you know what you're going to get.
Right.
And you know what you're going to get with Biden. I mean, the risk with Biden is that it's not going to end up being Biden to the amount that it is Biden now. That may, but, you know, so that may get more complicated, but people really know. And, but, you know, I think from my perspective, this election is the most simple election of our lifetime in the sense that
sure.
we don't have to get in. I got interviewed the other day and they were asking me about if I really, what I knew about Trump's nuanced positions on this war. And I'm like, well, I know that if he becomes president and when he takes office in January, the issues are going to be different. I know he's going to support Israel. He said he's going to support Israel. He's been the most supportive president in the history for Israel. He's done X, Y, and Z. Like, yeah, but he hasn't said how he would respond to Rafah. I'm like, wait, this presidential election is different. Like, we know him. We right. know what he'd be like. Correct. He's been there before, and we know Biden.
And,
he's
and
there
by the
now.
Way, he has said how he would respond to Rafah. People are deliberately misinterpreting him, right? He has said over and over, Israel needs to finish this war. Do you think he really means that Israel needs to not go under Rafah?
Right.
We
no.
all know what he means. What
he's
he means is that Israel needs to speed it up.
Yes.
Which, by the way, he's totally right. Of course Israel should have sped it up. Israel should have gone in hard, and they should have gone in fast, and they shouldn't have taken 6 months to do this. And if it had meant breaking more things, they still would be in a better position, just on a strategic level. Put aside the moral for a second, which again, you make the argument that Israel has taken more time specifically to be nicer to Gazan civilians and to avoid killing as many of them. But on a pure geopolitical level, if the idea was you want to maintain international support, timeline matters. And the longer you take, the less support you're going to have. So when Trump, who does understand, the man has, if there's one thing he understands, is his finger on the pulse of public perception. When Trump says, if you go fast, then you'll have support. And if you go slow, you won't. He is correct about that.
Yep.
And Israel should have taken note of that right at the very beginning.
Yeah, and he also said in that same interview, I think that you're referencing, he started out by saying, they asked him, what would you have done if your kids or grandkids were kidnapped? And he said, I would have done exactly what Israel is doing.
Right.
Right? So what Israel did, you should do it quicker.
I mean, by the way, like this is the thing about Trump on foreign policy. So having met him, but also having watched him, right, Trump has a very simple view of foreign policy. And the reality is that when you're the biggest bully on the block, a simple view of foreign policy is quite good. This is why I worked for Reagan. It turns out that when you have the most powerful military in world history,
and you're willing to use it.
And you're willing to use it. And people think that if they cross you, you might destroy them. That's a pretty good position to be in, right? Being able to threaten people with utter destruction and then occasionally demonstrating that you're willing to do that thing gets them to do many of the things that you'd like to do. And Trump has that. I mean, that is how he approaches foreign policy issues. He's like, yeah. If you do X, I'm going to wipe you out. And maybe they believe you and maybe they don't, but they believe there's a chance that he might do it.
Right. Biden did the opposite. He whispered don't to Hezbollah, and they've been attacking every single day.
He has no credibility, none. I mean, because and then he basically dared Putin into invading Ukraine. A few weeks before Putin invades Ukraine, he's like, well, if it's just a territorial incursion, like a small territorial incursion. No, wrong. As opposed to Trump, who would have said, if you take one step over this line, I'm going to be bombing Moscow. Now, would he really have done that? Who the hell knows? He's Donald Trump.
But if there's a 5% chance, they're not going to take it.
Exactly. Joe Biden is constantly saying the quiet part out loud of the weakest possible American position and then trying to backfill that with just don't. Well, I mean, he said don't to the Houthis, and they've been bombing the shipping in the Red Sea ever since. And everybody's now rerouting around the Cape of Good Hope. How many times can his bluff be called before he actually has to establish some form of credibility? And the answer apparently is endlessly, and he will never establish American credibility.
Yeah, for sure not. I mean, they've already crossed all, they being the Houthis and Hezbollah, have already crossed every line and Hamas
The only thing that remains to be seen is if an American ally crosses a red line, how hard will he come down on them? Right? He said, Israel, it might be a red line if you go into Rafah, but then he won't make clear what exactly that means. Okay, first of all, the worst position for any superpower to be in is to be more dangerous to its allies than to its enemies. And Joe Biden is more dangerous to his allies than he is to his enemies. He was more dangerous to our Afghan allies than he was to the Taliban. He's more dangerous to Taiwan than he is to China. He's more dangerous to Israel than he is to Iran. That's a very, very dangerous position to put America's allies, because then America's allies are going to start to triangulate because they have to.
Yeah. Well, something we talk about a lot, you and I, Ben, is about dealing with false narratives and anti-Semitism and all this craziness that's happening around the world. You know, you're the person who takes it on, head first, more than anyone that I know. You've debate people at Oxford, you're on college campuses. You go anywhere and everywhere to have these public debates with people. My real question is, why do you do it? I know you don't do it to get your name out there. Do you really think you're changing these people's mind? Do you think it's important to just try to, for someone to be making those arguments? I know they're not. It's not easy. It's not right. easy on you personally to do it. It takes time and you know even emotionally to stand in front of dozens and dozens of people who are wishing your death. Right? It's not my idea of a great afternoon. But what's your goal? What are you trying to get out of doing this?
So I think that before you do a debate, you always have to go in with the idea of what is this going to achieve. And so when I go to Oxford, for example, the goal is to speak to an audience that's not the people I'm directly speaking to, right? I'm speaking to the audience who's watching the interchange, and maybe this is the first time they're thinking about this issue and exposing the position for how false it is. Now, the nice thing about Oxford is that because Oxford is at least titularly a sort of non-political realm, it's not like stepping into full-on enemy territory. Like, I'm not interested particularly in, say, going on Al Jazeera, where the entire audience already hates Israel, and that's why they're watching Al Jazeera. Like, well, I'm not sure there's a point to that or to legitimizing a point of view on Al Jazeera that's going to actually achieve that. There are certain people where you're less debating than discussing, right? If I'm on Piers' show and I'm talking about Israel, it's not that Piers is necessarily anti what I'm saying. It's more of a discussion than it is, say, a debate. Piers tends to take a very British view of interviewing, which is adversarial in nature, but that's a bit of a different thing. You always have to have in mind who is the audience they are attempting to reach. And you have to juxtapose that to, as a person who has a very large platform, are you increasing the size of the audience for the person that you're debating? That's another consideration that you have to consider is, you know, there are people where if you give them a broader platform for bad ideas, you're actually increasing their exposure in an arena where you might not want to, right?
And they're bad ideas.
Right, and they're bad ideas. So you do have to make those sorts of, you know, math problems in your mind, that sort of calculus. What is the end goal? And every debate is different. Some of them are, again, very friendly. I've had debates with people on the left ranging from Anna Kasparian over at the Young Turks to an atheist named Alex O'Connor in the UK. That's a very friendly, interesting debate. And then I've been in some pretty, you know, rough and tumble debates where, again, it's less about having a productive discussion where you clarify views and more about exposing the view for what it is. But again, I think you have to go in with the end goal in mind. The truth is I try and do that with like normal everyday conversations, which tends to drive my wife a little crazy. But you have to kind of go into every conversation, I think, with an end goal as to what exactly this conversation is going to be.
So what's the end goal when you're at Oxford, let's say? You're doing those kind of debates where you're debating for people who haven't seen it, you know, for I think it was several hours,
Yeah, it was a while. Right. I mean, there were two debates. There's one in Oxford, one in Cambridge. And it really was like take all comers. There were two goals. One was to walk into the lion's den in a place that is extremely anti-Israel and has a lot of students who are pro-Hamas, and plant a flag and say that there is somebody who's willing to take this position in hostile territory, and we're not afraid to take that position, to try and reclaim a center of Western civilization for the West. Oxford and Cambridge are fundamental centers of Western civilized thought, and reclaiming that from people who love Hamas seems like a good thing to do. Trying to plant a flag and say, no, 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 you don't get this institution. This institution is not for these viewpoints. I think that was very important. Also, I realized, obviously, that the historic setting meant there would be a lot more eyeballs on the debate. And so that was, I think, one of the purposes of that particular interchange.
Yeah, I think from, you know, when I'm involved in these kind of things, I think there's a second part to it. It's not just what you say or what is said. It's how you say it.
Right? 100%. The hardest part is keeping your temper. When you hear people say truly evil things, yes. Just kind of like keeping an even keel, or just be jackasses to you, like directly, which happened in the Oxford debate, right? People would get up and they would just personally insult me. It's like, okay, I have a few responses I can use here. I can come back at you, but then I look like I'm a child. I could kind of chide you and school arm you, which just looks kind of eh. Or I can just kind of let it go, accept it, be polite. And that's usually the best way to go. That doesn't mean it's the easiest way to go when somebody's insulting you.
Right, but the audience, on top of that, the audience that I'm referring to really is even the Jewish audience, and not just Jews, but also people that think similarly, to show that you can stand there with pride. You know, I visited Columbia University. I met with the students there. And, you know, that's a hotbed. It keeps getting worse every day. It keeps getting worse with anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, anti-colonialism, anti-everything you can think of. And everything under the sun, it makes no sense. But the people that are standing up for what's right do it really in a way that they're afraid. They're afraid to do it publicly.
Apologetic,
they're afraid. They're apologetic. They don't want to come in with strength. You know, so you just walk in there with your head held high, meeting with people in public in the middle of the square, like not we're not hiding out in any rooms. We're not afraid of anyone coming in. I think that's also critical. My daughter sent me frantic text messages. She'll be mad that I mentioned this. But that at University of Maryland yesterday, there was some incident of the pro-Hamas movement there, and the kids were afraid. And I told her, tell them to grow a pair and to get out there and be proud of who they are and not be afraid of who's on their campus. It's their campus. They have to be out there, right? So I think there is that sort of subtone of what you're doing.
And, you know, you have to – that doesn't mean that doesn't come with security risk. I mean, we were at Oxford. We obviously had pretty heavy security at Oxford. We had a security guy seated right behind me. There were a couple of people in the audience that were a little concerned about. It was not exactly the friendliest territory. I mean, if you go back and watch the tape, you can see that you know, there are people who have – anger written across their face, who are sitting as far away from me as you are from me right now, except my back was to them, which is always not like the best situation. My security guys, some of whom are here right now, they remember being like ready to go.
I could tell they're equally as nervous with me being here. So
yeah,
close
exactly.
To you,
but, yeah. Watch yourself.
Exactly. But listen, I think that in the times that we're living in, I mean, you're in a position where you can and you have to have security around you. But just sort of everyday Jewish students and Jews around the country, just to speak on that issue for a second, from my perspective, we have to be smart but not scared.
That's right.
And continue to be out there and not let the fear of being out there overcome us, because nothing good will come from that.
That's absolutely true. I mean, again, there's a difference between walking down a crime-ridden street in the middle of the night holding your wallet. I mean, that's a stupid thing to do. Or it's the middle of broad daylight. You can't be afraid to go out of your house. You have to walk out of your house. You need to get to work. I mean, that is what it is.
Yeah, like I told students from another university that I was sort of advising on some issues. I said, hey, you guys have two choices. Either A, you go forward with your event, because they were afraid to do their event because the university said it was not safe for them. Or you pack your bags up and go home, because right. If you're not safe on your own college campus, just go home. Don't be there. If you're going to be there, you got to fight. So listen, one thing that both of us, you at a trying to totally different level, but we face people involved in U.S. politics who are Jewish, who love Israel, face, you know, let's say the Tucker Carlson's of the world, who will charge us with saying, you know, well, you really don't love America if you love Israel, or dual loyalty, which is kind of the old charge. How do you deal with those kind of charges?
I mean, it's fundamentally an idiotic argument, and it's also an argument that you never heard made about literally any other group that has any love for a country that has commonality of interest. So you never hear this made about Irish people, right? Joe Biden proudly will go to Ireland and talk about, oh, my roots are in Ireland. I love Ireland. And nobody's ever like, oh, dual loyalty. That guy really, he works for the Irish. I mean, that's really what he's all about. And you never hear this about Florida has a very large Cuban population. The population here obviously loves America. And also, they love Cuba, and they really want the Castro regime overthrown, and they care very deeply about what happens in Cuba. We have Venezuelan expatriates and Argentinian expatriates. We have people. America is filled with people who have roots in another country, or have family in another country, or have interests in other countries. And that's never been considered at odds with the United States. If you're an American, obviously you should care most about what America needs. And that means that, for example, there are many policies that I think would be good for Israel if America would do them. And also, I'm an American, and I don't think America should do it. So, for example, would it be good for Israel if America deployed the U.S. military to just go in and wipe out Hamas and Hezbollah? Of course, that would be amazing for Israel. Do I want, as an American, America to do that? Of course not. I'm an American. I don't want American soldiers in harm's way to protect even an ally. It's Israel's job to protect its own security, right? There's the kind of absurd contention that if I wish America to back her allies to the point where it's in America's interest to back her allies, and that I care about the survival of the state of Israel and the thriving of the state of Israel, this amounts to dual loyalty. Number one, you're assuming that there is an absolute conflict between wanting what is good for Israel and wanting what's best for the United States. There is not. Number two, if those two things come into conflict, then I'm an American. I want America to do what is in America's interest. And it's in America's interest to back her ally in Israel. And also, there are plenty of things that would be in Israel's interest that I don't want America to do. And so, like, that's a pure, easy example of how this is such a specious and false argument. Also, frankly, when you have people who are gallivanting around the globe to foreign countries, talking about how wonderful those foreign countries are and how much America sucks and how America's terrible and how everything here is bad, but then they're often in, say, Moscow talking about the grocery prices, you know, like, I'll take it with a grain of salt.
Right. For me, those people who make those arguments and it's not just one person. A lot of people make those kind of arguments. They fall into two categories, and there is overlap in them. One is they're just anti-Semites looking for an excuse to say something bad about Jews. That's one. And the other are isolationists who look at anything that happens outside of our borders as not in America's interest. And I think that's the most narrow argument that could be made. Our country, our world is so small these days. What happens, we're seeing it now with the border.
Right, one of these is immoral and one of them is wrong. Right? And there's a difference between the two of them. Right? The sort of, if you care about what happens to Israel, it's because you work for Israel. That argument is in the anti-Semitic category. And then there's the argument that, like, you shouldn't care about anything that happens outside America's borders. And that's not Israel-specific, so it really has nothing to do with anti-Semitism.
Right.
Those people would say presumably the same thing about World War II with regard to the Brits. It'd be like, oh, well, do we have any stake in the Brits? I mean, they're very far away. That's a big water. Like, you know, I think that's wrong. I think that's ignorant of how foreign policy works. I think it's nearsighted. And I think it's dangerous for the United States on a generalized foreign policy level. I don't think it has anything to do with being anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I agree with you. There is overlap. There are people who fit into both categories.
Yeah, for sure.
I think we agree that those are the categories. But let's talk about the most important thing, sort of to wrap on this, because you know you're known for a lot of different things, books and podcasts. But I think you're going to go down in history as the world's best rapper. Is that possible?
I don't want to toot my own horn or pat myself on the back before I enter the Rap Hall of Fame.
But. Yeah. So tell us about that. You put out this rap song with Tom McDonald, right? And
yes.
And facts, and somehow, because you have a lot of fans and the conservative movement thought
and
it was hilarious.
Tom has an enormous amount of fans, and Tom's a genius at what he does.
Yes. I mean, it was on the top of the charts for a while.
It made for an enormous number of amazing Purim costumes, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that. Some of those people were like, it was a great couple's costume. People were dressed, generally, sadly, the women were dressing up as me and the men were dressing up as Tom McDonald. That was usually how it went. But in any case, I mean, the way that happened is that I met Tom, I think it was 2019. I was walking around LA on Rodeo Drive. And this crazy-looking dude comes charging up to me on the street on Rodeo Boulevard, Rodeo Drive, with my wife, and we have a couple of kids in the strollers. And, I mean, you've seen Tom in the video. He's, like, tatted up. He's got the dreads.
Your security was really happy he came up.
I think we were without security at that point. And I was like, oh, no. And Tom comes charging up. He's like, can you take a picture? I'm a huge fan. I'm like, okay. And then I searched him. I'm like, hey, this is interesting. That's kind of weird. All right. And a couple of years go by, and he wants to come on the show to promote one of his latest songs. And executive producer Justin, who knows him and knows his producer Nova, who's an amazingly talented person, terrific editor, really good at what she does. They came on the show and we started joking about maybe we should do a rap song together. And Tom was super into this. And Tom was like, okay, you know what? We're going to do this. We're going to do this thing if you're up for it. I was like, okay, I'm totally up for it. And so that's pretty much how it came about. Tom wrote all of his lyrics and then he wrote kind of a sample lyric for me so I could see what the rhythm was. And then I edited that lyric very, very heavily, and then I sent it back to him. We kind of went back and forth. So I'll say that the final lyric that I speak is a sort of joint effort. I will say that any reference to compound interest is obviously from me directly. I insisted that we have if we're going to do a rap song, I want a compound interest to be in there. We did cut another line that had a reference to EBITDA. There was a reference. I'm trying to remember. The original lyric was too harsh for Tom. Tom cut it because he was like, this goes too hard. It like really went after Cardi and Nicki and like a bunch of other people in vicious ways. And Tom was like, I think this is too much. I think we'll save this for the diss track. And so we ended up with the lyric that we ended up going with. But listen, Tom's an amazingly talented guy. He's great at marketing. Same thing with Nova. Nova edited it beautifully. It's a beautifully edited video. And then of course it ends up going viral. And it's the funniest thing in the entire world. It's super duper funny. I was glad that everybody got the joke because the left has a tendency whenever I do something funny to pretend that I'm not joking.
Yeah.
So when I burn Barbies, obviously I'm totally serious.
Right.
And so when this came out, I mean, I'm pretty obviously joking. I was gratified that people like went with the joke. And, it's really
particularly
funny.
The rappers you called out, like, right? It was Nicki.
Nicki went along with it. Yeah. Nicki like put out a tweet saying that I wasn't nearly as bad as she thought I was going
to
be.
Yeah, the left wanted to get mad. The media wanted to get mad at it, and they got the joke. And it's interesting. It shows and it shows that sometimes or most of the time, the media and the narrative that we think is the prevailing narrative in our country isn't really the prevailing narrative in our country.
Most people in the country are pretty happy, and most people in the country, I think, want to just lead a normal life. And I think that most people are willing to get a joke. And then you have, like, X-Land, right, Twitter-Land, where everyone is insane. And again, the phrase I keep using all the time now is everybody needs to go outside and touch some grass. Just go outside and touch some grass and realize that you're in like a real world with things and people in
an amazing country. And if you think about like the Luke Combs doing Fast Car for Tracy Chapman and somehow Rolling Stone, if I'm not mistaken, some magazine wrote this whole article trying to make it some negative thing that Luke Combs is like erasing a black singer's song. And, you know, I'm around that, you know, I'm in my 40s, and like, and I grew up with that, so it was one of my favorite songs. And Luke Combs came out. He's like, what are you talking about? This was my favorite song. I was a kid in the country driving around in a pickup truck with my dad singing this. This was one of my favorite songs, an homage to her, the opposite. And she also was like, she was so much so, she sang it with him. And, right. that, and that became like, I think her song went up to the top of the charts as well again, right? So it's the same thing. And by the way, to tie it to what's happening with the U.S. and Israel, you know, every time they do a poll, they just did one a few weeks ago on the U.S. sentiment on Israel versus Hamas. It turns out that those on Twitter and those on college campuses and those behind microphones at CNN and MSNBC don't actually dictate the way Americans feel.
No, that's it. That's exactly right. And again, I would urge more politicians to log off a little bit. Like, go talk to your constituents. Go walk around in your district a little bit. You know, go realize that the vast majority of Americans actually want to just kind of lead normal lives and actually have enough moral clarity to recognize the difference between Democratic allies who were slaughtered in their beds and a genocidal terror group that wishes to kill every Jew in the world. Like, most people know this innately, and it's only the terminally online, and they really are. I mean, it's like a terminal case at this point. And the country's going to die of it. I mean, unless you perform some social media chemo and, like, get off your damned phone for 5 seconds, it will kill the country. It really will.
Yeah, I'll expand what you say. So other than watching our podcast, people should get off their phones. But not just politicians, just people. People need to get out and meet and have real conversations. Like,
this is what Shabbos is for, guys. I mean, God said rest on the seventh day specifically for this.
Yes.
And whether you're Christian or whether you're Jewish, like, take one day a week, get off your phone, go hang out with people in your community, go to church, go to synagogue, and, like, get back in touch with actual human beings.
Yes, exactly. Anyways, well, thanks so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you enjoyed. I'll see you next week. Make sure to subscribe and follow and all those awesome things you do to support podcasts.